Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
This is A.B. Dauji.
And of course,
this is The Big Picture.
So, for the last couple of weeks, I went off to Russia. Russia with 50 people. And what an amazing experience it was. Impossible to adequately describe. Majestic, towering buildings, incredible waterways like Venice and Amsterdam. Late night cruise through a network of rivers through the cities. Feasting on exotic desserts while gliding by palaces all lit up. The word is Maja. Yeah, St. Petersburg, a bustling, friendly shopping hub. Wide streets, beautiful parks and gardens and striking museums and cathedrals. Friendly, welcoming people. A huge city with the main masjid located right at the center. Jumma Salah. That was so heartwarming. A cosmopolitan atmosphere. People from all corners of this huge, huge, huge country, Russia. Then it was off to Kazan, a predominantly Muslim area. There too, I saw one of the most beautiful masajids that I ever set eyes upon, with towering minarets reaching to the skies. The whole city embraced us, and we felt so much at home. A visit to a cultural village was a highlight. That's where we were given a class, well, of threading very tiny beads onto cloth with needle and cotton that was used to make topis, handmade topis. And I think I poked my finger at least a dozen times. Moscow is, of course, a bustling metropolis. Lots of activities there. The highlights being a visit to the Cosmonautic Museum, a huge display of man's epic journey into space. Some may remember the name Yuri Gagarin. We marveled at the size of the capsule that hurled cosmonauts into space. Everything was there. The space suits that they wore. The food that they took with them. In fact, these were in like plastic tubes, like big toothpaste tubes. And of course, there were those primitive computers of that time. A vast array of implements also and tools that they needed on that intrepid journey. When I walked slowly through the vast buildings, I couldn't help but wonder how brave these space pioneers were to venture into the unknown with, I would say, not very advanced technology and science, knowing that in an instant you could be burnt into dust by a fiery explosion as you either took off or came back into the Earth's atmosphere. You really have to have guts of steel to get into such a primitive capsule, the size of a VW Combi, maybe slightly bigger. Again, an unforgettable experience was a visit to the central Moscow Masjid. And it was Juma time. People were streaming in, streaming like tsunamis all along the streets leading to the masjid. All the various streets. And what a masjid, eh? Massive, four floors, with a capacity, we were told, of over 15,000 musallis. The imam was waiting for us. Of course he was waiting for us. We're all VIPs, you see. And he took us through a back entrance to the packed, into the packed masjid to occupy the front row, specially reserved for us. And after salah, we went to the dining hall of the masjid where tables were laid out for us only for us. No, it wasn't dalgos, but something that could close, that very closely rivaled Mehmen Akni. Now, I can tell you so much about our visit, but it will fill the whole program. Best way to describe it is Maja. Oh, yes, one more thing. The brothers, this is an important part. The brothers in the group had one very, very serious complaint. They said that lowering of gazes was a very big problem. Very big problem. Well, for me, it isn't a problem because I don't look at ladies. But I had a shock stick to keep the delinquent brothers in check. A buzz from behind got them instantly to lower the gazes. One lady told her husband, "You just look up at the sky and walk. I'll hold your hand to lead you." So there you are, folks. Russia, a real eye-opener. Mind-blowing. Of course, for us South Africans, it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling to know that you have no concern for security. Even when you are in the bustling streets right up to 2 a.m. Maja. And so, like the cosmonauts, we came crashing back to Earth, to reality, to our beautiful country, so much filled with ugliness. The ugliness of crime and grime, the ugliness of broken infrastructure, broken economy, broken promises and broken dreams. The healthcare system, many things. Apartheid was a crime against humanity, but corruption is a crime against hard-working citizens, struggling citizens, unemployment and poverty, hopelessness. Corruption on every level is hemorrhaging the economy. It's like a cancer eating away at our dreams, hemorrhaging the economy, bleeding to death. And the tamasha just never ends. It never ends. We the citizens watch like spectators as the ANC is at war with itself. We are told that the pro-Zuma faction is trying to scuttle the anti-corruption faction led by Mr. Tumamina. It's open warfare. First, Pravin was targeted. Here's the question. Did he steal any money? And the answer is no. The story is that he went after Julius Malema to pay around 20 million rands in taxes. That's been the story. That was what he owed SARS. So Pravin went after him. Julius never forgot this. I think he lost his farm and his house and so on, had to be auctioned in order to pay that bill. And now Derek Hanekom is in the spotlight. Big news at the moment for the whole week. So this is the context about Derek, the background. It is alleged that Jacob Zuma captured the state over a period of 8 years. This is what we've been told. Stories emerge regularly about such looting over the past 8 years. But the ANC protected him, refused to act. The EFF, shouting very loudly, of course, inside and outside parliament, that Zuma must go, pay back the money, pay back the money. But the ANC was unmoved. Of course, many people believed that at the first whiff of corruption, Zuma should have gone right at the start. Shouldn't have been left alone to carry on and on. That's what people think. And of course, that was the right thing to do. Let me say that once again. That was the right thing to do. At the first whiff of corruption, they should have suspended him, investigated, and, well, maybe he could have been cleared. But it should have been done right at the start when the, whatever it is, hit the fan. ANC veterans were calling on the party to do it. Veterans, respectable people were saying, you know what, remove him. Do the right thing. But he didn't do that. So Derek Hanekom also called for his removal. He asked for a motion of no confidence in parliament, which was defeated. And of course, he's an executive member of the ANC. So he met with the EFF's Goodrich Gardi at, Mug and Bean in Sandton. Nothing wrong with that. The EFF was on the right track, and the ANC wasn't. But no. Not a good thing. ANC's Ace Magashule announced 2 days ago that this was highly unacceptable because the ANC constitution says you cannot discuss things with opposition parties. So Honeycomb was, we are told, colluding with the enemy because the ANC had taken the decision not to remove Zuma. So Honeycomb went against party rules. Party rules? Party rules. Police. What nonsense. The well-being of the country comes first, not party rules that says that we decided not to remove a president who seemed to be steeped in corruption. All those who decided not to immediately stop state capture should now themselves be hauled over the coals and asked why they didn't do it. You see? One may even say that that was a crime of collusion against the state and its people for protecting Jacob Zuma for so long, or no, for not removing him. Not so when it comes to Derek Honeycomb's coffee chat. Again, the question, did Honeycomb steal 1 cent? No. But Ace Magashule, the Secretary General, called Honeycomb a charlatan, meaning a false person, a hypocrite, a clown, and that his action of having coffee and possibly discussing Zuma was akin to treason. He said that Honeycomb's actions were divisive, meaning that he was trying to divide the ANC. That, my dear listeners, is a steaming pile of bull manure. Honeycomb didn't take, he didn't take a cent, not 1 cent. But allegations after allegations are coming out about corruption in which Ace is said to be involved, especially about the Estina dairy looting spree. Let me unpack that a bit. In 2012, a dairy project was set up at a farm near the town of Freire to empower black farmers. It was to be a partnership between the state and a company called Estina. And Estina held 49% of the shares. Estina was given the land in a 99-year lease. Estina was supposed to contribute 228 million rands to the project. But nothing happened. 100 black farmers were told that they were going to be given 5 cows each, and that if they already had a few cows of their own, they should sell them because you're going to get now a new lot of cows. Well, they didn't receive any cows. Here's an extract from with the Wikipedia. Newspaper reports allege that 30 million rands in government funds intended for the project was instead laundered through Dubai and used to pay for the 2013 wedding ceremony of Vega Gupta at Sun City and accounted for as a business expense. In January 2018, City Press claimed that only 1% of the 220 million rands allocated to the dairy by the Free State government was spent on actual farming. 1%. With most of it being diverted to associates of the Guptas. Bank statements showed that the Free State government paid 334 million to the farm over 2 years, with the project transferring most of the money to its bank accounts in India and only small amounts spent on the farm itself. The Hawks raided the offices of Ace Magashule, the premier of the Free State, in connection with the project. Right. So there you are. Many commentators say that Ace Magashule is part of the alleged Zuma faction, and that is why he is gunning members of the opposition faction, including Derek Honeycomb, and ultimately Cyril Ramaphosa. Meanwhile, South Africans are still looking for some light at the end of the tunnel. Cynics are saying that the light at the end of the tunnel is a train coming in our direction. But you know what really had me laughing? Listen to this. On Tuesday, Ephraim Dlamini, one of the project's beneficiaries, told the Zondo Committee, he was supposed to benefit from this, getting the 5 cows and so on. So he gave evidence in front of the Zondo Commission that farmers were promised trips to India for training and cattle to kickstart the project. That's what they were promised. Okay, we give you 5 cows and then you're going to go to India and learn how to do cattle farming. Instead, the former agriculture MEC in the Free State, Mosibenzi Zwane, sent members of his church choir for training. That was what was told at the Zondo Commission. Dlamini said Zwane's father was a pastor and in charge of the choir. So, instead of sending the farmers, Zwane paid to send his father's church choir. But you know what made me laugh? Was that this choir group had to cut the trip short and race back to South Africa because the whole thing backfired in India. Or should I say, there was a very explosive situation in India. And what was that? Well, they all got severe diarrhea and had to come running back. Oh, I tell you, man. Right, let's leave sunny South Africa and go overseas. Now, last month, British Prime Minister Theresa May, she resigned. Well, all I can say is that aapne kamal kar diya. Aapne kamal kar diya. The translation of that is, you have done something amazing. But you know, I have a different meaning. You have produced kamal. You have made kamal. That's right. The new British Prime Minister is Boris Kamal. Actually, that should really be his surname, Kamal. But somewhere along the line, the family changed it to Johnson. There's a very brief family tree. Follow this, right? A very brief family tree. As you can hear from my voice, I got a bit of a flu, just the usual run-of-the-mill flu. And somebody stopped me the other day and said, Mr. Dauji, what do you say? Is it acceptable, is it normal for Muslims to have swine flu? Eh? Is it okay for Muslims to have swine flu? I don't know. I just walked away. I shook my head and walked away. Maybe somebody can take out the fatwa from the batwa. Fatwa from the batwa. Batwa means from your pocket. My dad taught me that. Long time ago, they used to say that people were taking fatwas out of batwas. There you are. You learn something new all the time on the big picture. Right, so let's see now about this new British Prime Minister. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's great-grandfather on his father's side was Ali Kamal, a journalist for the Ottoman Empire, now of course known as Turkey. He traveled a lot all over the place because he was a journalist, and he went to Switzerland, and there he met this Anglo-Swiss lady, Wilfred Braun. She's the daughter of Margaret Johnson. Remember the name. She's the daughter of Margaret Johnson. And Ali Jamal was a prominent in Turkish politics. This was around the 1900s. And he actually became the Minister of Interior, the last Minister of Interior in the Ottoman Empire. So he was a big deal politician. But his politics got him into trouble. And then one day he was kidnapped from a barber shop. And he was being transported, I don't know if they were going to try him or something somewhere, but a mob got hold of him and they tortured him and beat him and hanged him. Now, Ali Kamal's son and daughter were at that time living in England, and so they changed the name to Johnson. Kamal's son, Wilfred Johnson, married Irene Williams, and their son was Stanley Johnson. Right, Stanley Johnson, who is Boris Johnson's father. You got it? You following the family tree, or you just fell off the branch? So, no wonder that the Turkish newspaper Sosku had this headline: Ottoman grandson becomes prime minister. How's that, headline? Ottoman grandson becomes prime minister. So Turkish politicians, including President Erdogan, and the media are all celebrating, sending messages of congratulations, hoping that British-Turkish ties will improve. But our Boris Johnson, Kamal, is a bit of a kachumbar, a mixed masala. According to an article in the Jerusalem Post this week, Boris's great-grandfather on his mother's side was a fellow by the name of Elias Avery Lowe, a Moscow-born Jew. So there you are, folks. He's got Muslim blood and Jewish blood flowing inside him. So the question is there some sort of war carrying on inside him? Very difficult to say, but it seems like it. Here's what he said. Right, these are some of his quotations. I feel Jewish when I feel the Jewish people are threatened or under attack, and that's when it sort of comes out. When I suddenly get a whiff of anti-Semitism, it's then that you feel angry and protective. So, that's it. But wait, hang on. When Jewish groups objected to the march every year on what is known as Al-Quds Day in London, when Hezbollah flags were flown, Johnson was the mayor of London at that time, and he refused to ban the march. Incidentally, who actually banned the march? The next mayor after Johnson, Sadiq Khan. Can you believe it? In 2014, Boris called the attack by Israel on Gaza disproportionate, ugly, and tragic. Then when elections were taking place in his conservative party, which had a huge number of Jews joining it from the Labour Party, they all dashed off to the conservative party. That's when Boris described himself as a passionate Zionist. He said, "It's totally unacceptable that rockets are fired from Gaza against innocent Israeli civilians." I think we'll take a break there for some ads and come back after this. Right, welcome back. Let me just go over some of the things I spoke about before the break. And, I was telling you that this Boris Johnson is a bit of a mixed masala. He's got Jewish blood in him, and he's got Muslim blood in him, if there's such a thing. And so sometimes he's attacking Israel, and sometimes he's attacking the Muslims. Sometimes he's favoring them, and so on. Like I said, in 2014, he called the attack by Israel on Gaza disproportionate, ugly, and tragic. Then when elections were taking place in his conservative party, which had a huge number of Jews, they all left the Labour Party and they went over to the conservative party. He described himself as a passionate Zionist. He said it's totally unacceptable that rockets are fired from Gaza against innocent Israeli civilians. He is known to have got the United Nations to produce a resolution condemning Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. And then, on the flip side, he mocked Muslim women wearing the niqab, saying that they look like letterboxes. You know, the slit of the eyes? He said that it looks like a letterbox. So you see, it appears that the Jewish blood and Muslim blood inside him are at war. Of course, I'm just kidding, right? Hey, nobody get on your high horse out there. But on the question of mixed masala, Boris Johnson, Kamal, as I said, as you know, is the new British Prime Minister, the top man in the UK. Top man in the UK. But guess what? He was born in America. Huh? Yeah. His father, Stanley Johnson, was an economics student at Columbia University. So he came from England and he was studying at Columbia University in 1964 when his son Boris was born at a hospital in New York. His father decided that it would be of great advantage for Boris to have dual US-British citizenship, so they then registered him in New York. Later on, his parents moved back to Britain. Now, 50 years later, the United States asked Boris to file his tax return because he was still a U.S. citizen. So they said, okay, let's see your tax returns. Oh, Mamlo was getting a bit gambir. Right, let me just adjust something here. Right, so the situation is getting a bit sticky. And when they asked him to file his tax return, although he was living in Britain since the age of 5. And Boris said, what a load of nonsense. And then he immediately gave up his American citizenship. But later on, he paid the taxes that were outstanding because as mayor of London, he had to go to America. He had to tour some of the cities there, and they would have nabbed him for not paying taxes. Right at the airport, they would have nabbed him. So that would have been very embarrassing. Anyway, that is the story of our Boris Kamal, this former American Muslim Jewish British Prime Minister from Kankiri Gam in Turkey. Kankiri, that's his gam, the province in Turkey. By the way, the home in which Boris's great grandfather lived, it's actually situated right on the Bosphorus River in Istanbul. I saw a picture of that today. Absolutely fabulous mansion. It's known as the Zeki Pasha Waterside Mansion, very famous. And guess what? It's up for sale. That's right. It's up for sale. It's a really fantastic property with 23 bedrooms and 5 bathrooms spread along 5 floors. Majestic building. Really fantastic. I mean, I would have gone for it myself, but I got a house already. But all you Lanis out there, you better act very fast. It's up for sale. Get all the upling out. Upling. Get all the upling out from under the mattress. And yes, the price. Well. Actually, yeah, it's not so bad. Yeah, not so bad for all you Lanis out there. The price is just $96 million. Let me get my calculator out here. Let me see. $96 million, that would work out to R1,372,320,000. Not bad, eh? Not bad. For you Lani's pocket money for you guys. R1,372,320,000. So, how did Boris become Prime Minister? No. There was no general election in Britain. When Theresa May of the Conservative Party, she was battling with this Brexit thing and all of that, and she resigned. She resigned as Prime Minister. Her party, the Conservative Party, had to choose who was to replace her. Just like when Zuma was removed, the ANC had elections amongst themselves and picked Ramaphosa. So the elections were within the Conservative Party, and about 180,000 members voted. And Boris won by 100,000 and his opponent got only 80,000. So a very tiny part of British society, the British population, picked him to be the Prime Minister. Just 100,000 people. And at his first speech, He waved his hands around and he punched the air and put on a very stern, very tough face, a fighting face, that he will be very tough with Europe in dealing with this question of Brexit. You know, I'm actually sick of hearing about Brexit. Sick. I didn't want to know what's it about. But eventually I decided to take a look, because it looks like it's going to carry on for a couple of months though. Oh, by the way, in his first speech in the Commons, in the House of Commons on Thursday, the Prime Minister was addressing Jeremy Corbyn of the opposition. And he said, how on earth could he, Corbyn, ask about Iran? The Right Honourable Gentleman, who has been paid by Press TV of Iran, who repeatedly sides with the mullahs of Tehran rather than our friends in the United States over what is happening in the Persian Gulf. How incredible we should even think of entrusting that gentleman with the stewardship of this country's security. you know this business about the ships being commandeered or hijacked, the Iranian ship in Gibraltar, and then the Iranians took a British ship, and so this big standoff that's carrying on. So this guy, Boris, decided that he's going to take the American position, which is putting Iran in the dog box. In other words, saying that we can't be in friendly with the mullahs in Tehran. But then his bully, Stanley Johnson, he spoke on Press TV just a few hours later about his son becoming the UK Prime Minister. I think the old man didn't hear the speech in Parliament attacking Iran. So he went innocently on TV and he said the Prime Minister loves Iran and that he is very much looking forward to him building bridges with Iran. Iran to him will mean, I don't know, a whole lot of things. And he said this whole business about the tankers, the oil tankers and all that, it'll be solved by his son Boris. Easy peasy. Those are his words. Easy peasy. I think Boris and his father are going to have a very tense breakfast. Right, so where were we now? Let's see. While I got sidetracked with this easy-peasy stuff. So, as I said, this Brexit thing was irritating me, so I had to look into it. So this is what it is, very simply. Britain is part of the European Union. And what is the European Union, or the EU? Well, it's a union. It's a coming together of 28 countries of Europe, and that also includes Britain. The agreement between them allows goods and people to move around as if it was one big country. You know, tariffs and all put aside, and passports and all of those things, yeah. So that was all put aside. And also 19 of the countries use one currency, the euro. So in Britain, a referendum took place, voting took place on the 23rd of June 2016 to decide whether Britain should still remain within this union, the European Union, or should leave, exit out of this union, exit. Britain exiting. That's how it's shortened to Brexit. Britain exiting. You got it? So, 51.9% voted to leave. So the Prime Minister Theresa May sat down with the European Union leaders to see how Britain could leave but still have some sort of advantages, like in trade, in dealing with the European countries and so on. Britain still owed the EU £39 billion. Now I'm not going to convert that, but it's a lot of money. £39 billion times, I think, 18 or something. That's how much money Britain had to pay the EU to come out. So it gets a little complicated. Theresa May failed to get a good deal. According to the agreement with the EU, on October 31st this year, the divorce will be final. Finish. So in came Boris. Teresa failed, and in came Boris with arms swinging. He said very loudly, determinedly, deal or no deal, we are out. That's it. We are out. So let's start talking. Yeah, tough talk, like, you know, make them frightened in Europe. And then Europe came back and told him yesterday, footsack. So the situation is very serious. If Britain pulls out and does not pay the £39 billion, then there could be big problems for Britain in future, in its future dealings with the EU. Here's a short list of what will happen if there is a no-deal Brexit, leaving Europe without a deal. It says here, a no-deal Brexit could lead to a number of things happening. For example, number one, border checks could be reintroduced. That means you have to produce your passport if you're going to travel through all the countries there. British people have to do that. Transport and trade between the UK and the EU could be severely affected. Adults may not be able to drive in EU countries without a special driving permit. It could cost more money to use your phone abroad in EU countries. It could mean no transition period, which is part of the deal that Prime Minister Theresa May is proposing. Right, so to put all this together, the UK, Britain, would sever all ties with the EU with immediate effect, with no transition period, no guarantees on citizens' rights of residence. The government fears this could cause significant disruption to businesses in the short term, with lengthy tailbacks of lorries at the channel ports waiting to cross over into Europe, as drivers face new checks on their cargoes. Food retailers have warned of shortages of fresh produce, and the National Health Service is stockpiling medicines in case supplies from EU countries are interrupted. Government ministers and multinational companies with factories in the UK have also warned about the long-term impact on the British economy. Brexit-supporting MPs claim it would not be as bad as they say, and the UK would save on the £39 billion divorce bill, as well as being free to strike its own beneficial trade deals around the world. So they said, okay, we have a divorce, we don't have to pay anything. No, we won't pay, so we're saving, so it'll be still good for us. So this is a big debate that's carrying on there. Now, Brexit, that's the brief story, or shall I describe it as Brexit for dummies? Well, that's me before I researched it. I hope you got a broad understanding of the issue now. So Boris Johnson Kamal is stubborn and is in a fighting mood. If nothing happens by October 31st, no deal, then the British economy could start sagging, going into recession. And then Boris Mamu could have a very big headache. And maybe it won't even last long. With all his tough talk, when the chips are down, probably they'll have elections thereafter, and then he may be out. And some people are very worried that the opposition party, the Labour Party, could win, and Jeremy Corbyn could be the next Prime Minister. And some people are not savouring that possibility, especially supporters of Israel, because they feel his party is full of anti-Semites and against Israel and all that stuff. Right, talking about, let's see, the big headache that Boris Johnson... By the way, talking about his head, I always wonder if he's got a yellow mop on his head. It always... Well, it looks a bit untidy, doesn't it? Have you seen for it? Looks like he had a haircut with garden scissors, the shears, you know, garden shears. And then another fellow with a weird hairstyle of the same color is across the ocean from England. Hey, and of course you know him. Our man, President Pagla. Now, let me say this. Besides that weird hairstyle, One can't compare the mentality of the two blondies. You can't compare the mentalities at all. Shall I say that Boris has got a very good mind? He's regarded as being very, very intelligent, highly intelligent, very well spoken. I read an article about him. He's very smart. He can grasp an issue immediately. If there's a problem, he can grasp the issue immediately. Very, very intelligent. Very articulate. Very articulate. So he's got a very good mind. And of course, my man Donald's got no mind at all. Hey? Let me put it this way. If ever it happened, by some strange miracle, that an idea, one idea came into Donald's head, it would die of loneliness. The man is like a cartoon character, Goofy. And Boris, when he was mayor of London, had some, well, shall I say, not so nice words about Donald Bai. Not so nice words. Let me give you some examples. After Donald Trump wrongly said in 2015, you may remember this, that there were no go zones, no go areas in London where police wouldn't go because of Muslim extremists. That's what Donald Trump said. There are parts of London where police can't go because the Muslim extremists are there. No go area. Johnson, who at that time served as mayor of London, said that Trump demonstrated a quite stupefying ignorance that makes him, frankly, unfit to hold the office of President of the United States. And then Johnson also added, I would invite him to come and see the whole of London and take him around the city. But I don't want to expose Londoners to any unnecessary risk of meeting Donald Trump. What an insult. What an insult. Let me say that again. I would invite him to come and see the whole of London and take him round the city. But I don't want to expose Londoners to any unnecessary risk of meeting Donald Trump. When Donald Trump proposed a Muslim immigration ban in the United States, Johnson called it complete and utter nonsense. I think Donald Trump is clearly out of his mind. And when Donald Trump was about to win the election in 2016, Johnson said, I am genuinely worried that he could become president. Let me repeat the part about the part Trump demonstrated. Let me just see if I can find it again. This is what Boris said, that Trump demonstrated a quite stupefying ignorance that makes him, frankly, unfit to hold the office of President of the United States. Stupefying. Right. Sure. Ish. What a lucky club that was. Eh? But hey, that was all in the past. All in the past. Since then, these two blonde mopheads kissed and made up. When Boris was elected Prime Minister, Trump said on Tuesday, well, he heaped praise on this new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, describing him as Britain Trump. Britain Trump. A stupid expression that is. Britain Trump. Or he should have said Britain's Trump. But he said no. Or British Trump. But no. He said, Donald Trump said, described him as Britain Trump during a speech to hundreds of teenage fans in Washington on Tuesday. The U.S. president said, we have a really good man who's going to be the Prime Minister of the U.K. now. He's tough and he's smart. They're saying Britain Trump. They call him Britain Trump. And people are saying that's a good thing. They like me over there. That's what they wanted. That's what they need. He'll get it done. Boris is good. He's going to do a good job. I don't know what to say. Really. I actually think that Boris would want to be pally with Donald Trump. Because if trading with the EU takes a dive after Brexit, that means if Britain leaves the European Union without any kind of a trading deal, which is going to take place in October. Remember the date, October 31st. Then Boris is hoping that the US could be a strong trading partner. There you are. Right. I think we're going to end the program now. We don't have too much of time left. Let me see what I've dug up for you from the light at the end of the tunnel graveyard. Huh? That's what I got for you. An Indian doctor, he couldn't find a job in any hospital in the United States of America. When he was a doctor, he moved to the United States. So he opens a clinic and puts a sign outside. Get treatment for $20. If not cured, get back $100. That was the sign. Get treatment for $20. If not cured, get back $100. Well, an American lawyer thinks this is a great opportunity to earn $100 and goes to the clinic. The lawyer says, I have lost my sense of taste. And the doctor says, nurse, bring medicine from box number 22 and put 3 drops in patient's mouth. So the nurse does that and the lawyer says, this is kerosene, this is petrol. And the doctor says, congratulations, sir, your sense of taste is restored. Give me $20. Well, the lawyer went away very annoyed. And after a few days, he goes back to recover his money. The lawyer says, I have lost my memory. I cannot remember anything. The doctor says, nurse, bring medicine from box number 22 and put 3 drops in his mouth. And the lawyer, very annoyed, said, hey, that is petrol. You gave this to me last time for restoring my taste. And the doctor said, congratulations, you got your memory back. Give me $20. The lawyer pays him, he was fuming, and he went away. And then he comes back a week later, determined to get his $100. And the lawyer says, my eyesight has become very weak. I cannot see at all. And the doctor says, well, I don't have any medicine for that, so take this $100. And the lawyer stares at the note and says, but this is $1, not $100. And the doctor says, congratulations, your eyesight is restored. Give me $20. You know, you can't beat an Indian, right? You can't beat an Indian. What else have I got for you? We've got another 2 minutes. Right. Here's another one for you. Are you ready? So, Kuas, I don't know if I told you this one before. Kuas and Dani are very dumb guys. Dumb. Kuas failed standard 2-3 times. And Dani was so hopeless that he even failed a urine test. Anyway, they had to write an exam to qualify for a job at the Isipingo municipality. In the last question, they had to fill in the blank. Old MacDonald had a... So there was a blank. Old MacDonald had a... And there was a blank. Kuas was stumped. And he whispers to Dani, hey, Boot! What's the answer to the last one, eh? And Dani whispers back, farm. And Kuas asks, how do you spell that, eh? And Dani replies, E-I-E-I-O. This is A.B. Dawji. Fitting you all, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.